It's difficult to remember back that far, but I would suspect that we were one of the bigger firms within the stock exchange at that time, because it was before the Wed-Jefferson-Derlacher-Godson merger. Mm. And we covered quite a bit of the stock exchange, which was unusual in those days. We did it quite deliberately in order to try and minimise the effects that we had felt with the controlled economy, how government action, unexpected government action, could in fact affect adversely the markets in which you dealt. And if it affected adversely, it meant that the volume out of that market disappeared, and you were faced with accumulating and mounting overheads, and no business, no profits, because there was no trading to produce the profits to counteract the mounting overheads. So the Blackwall, which was actually jobbing in an active oil market in those days, and from time to time active Rhodesian copper market, with Acro and Smithers, who were dealing in gilt-edged, in corporation stocks, which I don't think actually at that time were very active, but had a modicum of business, of Commonwealth stocks, which again were in the same sort of category, and in American stocks, American and Canadian stocks, a market which was not all that active, but had moments of excitement. It covered a large range and tended to insulate us, in that when there was a stop on the industrial side, there was probably a little activity going on in the gilt-edged side, and that the actual cycles of the industrial activity and the fixed interest activity tended to be slightly stepped and slightly different. Mm. As to partners, of course, it's difficult to recollect that at that particular time we were limited. Every partnership throughout the country was limited by statute to a total of 20 partners. Mm-hmm. I don't think we were anything like that. I have no recollection of how many we were, but I would think that it was not more than 15 and not less than 10. Mm-hmm. 10 to 15, therefore. Mm. Staff, I have no recollection at all. Mm. We had to have quite a number of staff to do the actual settlement, remembering that the settlement for oil shares, Rhodesian coppers, were for the account. And the settlement of gilt-edged Commonwealth corporation stocks, etc., were for cash. Mm-hmm. Created, as it were, two settlement sections within the office, and therefore probably required more staff than the average firm that only dealt in account stocks.
Yes. Was the oil market still an open cry market?
Oh yes, it remained an open cry. But now you mustn't be misled by that expression. That's a modern expression, mainly used for nowadays in connection with the option markets. Mm-hmm. Both the oil market and in the old CAFA market, in other words, South African mining shares, one used to bid and offer stock openly, but not all the time. Mm. So far as the traded option market is concerned, any activity is on an open cry basis. You can't actually deal unless you have an open cry, or it's more difficult to do that in the modern markets. In the old CAFA and oil stock market, the jobbers only went in and bid and offered stock if they wanted to move the price, or if they felt that somebody, another jobber in the market was making an unreal price and they wanted to test him, or they wanted to make him alter his price so that the price that the jobber offering or bidding for stock was the important one, yes. Then he would go into the market, but not otherwise.
Now, you mentioned earlier that large jobbing firms would have committees of partners that would decide things like policy.
Oh yes, but the large jobbing firms at that time didn't exist in the oil market.
Yes,
they were all small markets. We're talking about 53 to 56 now, and they were all small markets, small firms then. Mm.
But thinking about Aykroyd's, you say with a partnership of about 10 to 15, how did you decide policy as a company, as a firm?
I don't know that I remember very clearly about that, but I suspect that there was allocations of capital within which one had to make one's book, yes. And that is the traditional way of controlling the books within a company. Within a jobbing firm. I suspect that we began to develop that. In other words, the person, the partner in charge of the oil stocks had a global figure beyond which he was not permitted to go without reference. The partner in charge of the gilt stocks had a similar figure, that those figures were arrived at by negotiation between the partners concerned, remembering always that oil stocks were, you only had to settle on account day, and therefore were dealing for the account. Mm. Gilts were cash, and you dealt with for tomorrow, which was one of the attractions of the gilt market.
Yes. Which particular market were you dealing in?
Well, I started life in the oil market, as I told you, and then on the merger, I was nominated as the Blackwell partner, who went over and was allocated to the Gilt Edge market, which meant that I had to learn the techniques of another market. Mm.
Did you find this a very difficult exercise?
Difficult, no. Different, yes. Mm.
Could you suggest the ways in which it was different?
Well, we're talking about 53, and one must remember that it wasn't the same as the late 60s and 70s. Mm. The big development of the 50s and 60s, I suppose, was the emergence and growth of the savings institutions, and the way that they became big market factors. Mm. In the immediate period, in the immediate 50s, the market was still dominated by the private individual. A market dominated by the private individual meant that it was a relatively liquid market, in that the range of private individuals has a variety of influences applicable at any one time. an individual has his own private wealth that is invested, say. But from time to time, he will have calls on that investment, whether it be to finance the purchase of a new house, or whether it be to provide the funds for settlement of a daughter that's getting married. Mm. And there's a whole variety of influences which are applicable to various individuals within that, but those influences being all different. As the savings institutions began to grow in importance and grow as a specialist investment factor, and they grew because of the tax incentives that were given on the various types of savings. For instance, the tax deductibility of contributions, of an individual's contributions towards his pension. Mm-hmm. And the need for the trustees of that pension fund to invest the proceeds of that for the long term. Mm-hmm. You find a completely different form of influences coming into play in the market. Mm-hmm. And not any different in the way that those influences were satisfied. For instance, a pension fund invests for the longer term. It is, in theory at least, but probably not so much in practice these days, but in theory at least, able to ignore a number of short-term fluctuations that the individual would not be able to ignore, because the variety of influences on his investment policy, such as buying a new house, such as financing, setting a daughter up when she was married, such as financing a son going into business for the first time, and right across the range, those influences are much more short-term than the investment of a pension fund, in theory anyway. Mm. And so you got, during the 50s and the 60s, the transmission, the change in the type of the market, the moving away from the market dominated by the individuals that existed pre-World War II, that began to affect the market as the market recovered from after the end of World War II, and then the growth of the savings institutions stimulated deliberately by government, the attractiveness of investing, of investors, of individuals investing in that particular way, and the influence of that on the market concerned. Mm. So that you had, therefore, a change in the type of market, and jobbing firms had to adapt to that.
Mm. Were the institutions very interested in investing in gilts, in preference to equity shares?
Yes, of course they were, because if you look at it, a life company or a pension fund has at any one time a known actuarial demand on its funds. Therefore, it satisfied that known actuarial demand with fixed interest investments. That became a mathematical equation at any one time. The influence of the market came into that, in that it might be more advantageous to wait than to do it immediately, depending upon which way you read the market movement in the future. So that the savings institutions tended to concentrate on the fixed interest, and had always done. in their growth gradually, although their growth wasn't was only began to gather pace, I suspect, but I don't know the statistics of this. I suspect that it only began really to gather pace in the late 50s and onwards. But there was the cult of the equity, and as inflation grew, the rate of inflation grew, so the cult of the equity grew. And institutions and savings institutions realized that although the mathematical solution to the provision of a pension or the satisfaction of an actuarial calculation on a life policy might be obtained through the through an investment in fixed interest, nevertheless, in an inflationary era, there was a bonus to be obtained by investing in equities, where the yield, if you made the right investment, was unlikely to go down. And because of the inflationary tendencies, and don't forget that in the Labour government, during the period of the socialist governments in the 1950s and 1960s, the rate of inflation grew at a rate that would be totally unthinkable of now. That was reflected in their equity investments, and that gave them a bonus on their performance. And I suspect that if you look back onto the 50s and 60s, you would find, and I'm no judge of this because I was the jobber only reflecting it, and it was the brokers and their access to the institution's thought, that you would find that during this period there was a growth of the cult of the equity, and a greater proportion was entrusted of investment of their portfolios was entrusted to the equity market, because it was difficult to foresee any cessation in the growth of inflation. I think it was the pension trustee of the Imperial Tobacco Fund called Ross Gobie, I think, or Gooby, was the tremendous architect of the institutional investment into the equity market, which on the right terms provided a real bonus, yes, and for those, yes, that invested in their policy, their with profits policies, as opposed to the investments that were provided on a purely fixed interest basis.
If we can focus a little bit on the actual mechanics of jobbing in the gilts, yes, market, in contrast to your experience in oils, were the actual mechanics different?
The mechanics were different in that, first of all, you dealt for cash. If therefore you, although you were able to extend the delivery period, or the office was able to extend the delivery period. In fact, it was a bore to do that. And basically speaking, if you had to be prepared to, that was the form you were asked to, that was the basis on which you dealt. You dealt for cash tomorrow. It was possible to delay. Gradually, the money broker's role in this grew, and you were able to borrow stock in order to satisfy that. It was a complicated procedure. It was a procedure that became accepted in offices, but nevertheless involved staff and overheads, etc., etc. The techniques of dealing in the equity market, where you dealt for the account, were rather more more simple in some ways. You dealt for the account day. The account day was fixed. It wasn't a moving account. It was for a fortnight on from the normally a fortnight on from the beginning of the account, and that period gradually got less as you approached account day. It wasn't therefore a rolling account, which a number of people thought of at one time. You could deal within the account, the individual investor could deal within the account without suffering some stamp duty. And therefore, for the speculator, he was able to take a view within the account. If he took the a view over the account, he had to be prepared to pay the stamp duty, or alternatively had to be prepared to risk the ability to contango, in other words, to defer the settlement on interest rate terms, which I don't know is the official definition of a contango, but that's in effect what it meant.
Yes. Were there many jobbers dealing in the gilts market?
Oh yes, it was a very free market, even at the beginning, even when I began to know it of the 1953, it became infinitely freer, of course, when the government began to use the interest rate, the bank rate, as and a weapon in the attainment of its economic policy. And the bank rate, I don't think I shall ever forget it, moved unexpectedly and totally without warning in 1957, when it was moved up from 5% to 7%.
What were the, can you describe the actual immediate effects of that?
Immediate effects of it was absolutely dead silence. Everybody was stunned.
So, do you mean no one wanted to deal?
Well, no, in periods of uncertainty, people don't want to deal. People only want to deal when they think they can see their way. Whether that way is a clearly defined change or whether it's no change. But if you have immediately injected a period of uncertainty, then nobody wants to deal, and no, and therefore the market dries up completely. In that particular time, I shall remember it very well, because the market was bubbling. The market, there was a demand. People were coming in to invest. The Bank of England were sellers of stock, but they insisted, as they sold stock, of raising their price. Now, it was generally, at that particular time, and more so after it, everybody was very sensitive about the Bank of England's open market operations. They were sensitive because at that time, the bank and subsequently, the bank operated under a closed mouth basis. In other words, it did not believe, like the Federal Reserve in the US believed, that if you have a policy, the more people who know about your policy, the more likely you are to succeed. And in that context, you aren't afraid of opening your mouth and telling everybody what you want to achieve. The Bank of England at that time took the view that no, that it's should... I don't know why they took this particular view, but they took the view that it was better that nobody should know what their policy was, and the market should absorb the results of that. We got into a situation prior to the 1957, I think it was 57, rise in the of the bank rate by 2% for the first time for God knows how many years, from 5% to 7% suddenly. During the period immediately prior to that, they had been selling stock, but they had been raising their prices. So that indicated that they were not exactly upset about the demand for gilt edge market and for the resulting reduction in the interest rates that occurred because they raised the prices that they were prepared to sell stock. That happened up to the previous night, and then the next morning they raised the bank rate from 5% to 7%. And of course you can understand that anybody who was involved in any way in the gilt edge market was absolutely stunned at the comparison between what had happened the previous day and what actually happened at the 7% bank rate. I think it's quite possible that the connections with them, between the bank and them, and the market generally, not the jobbers, but the market generally, wasn't totally appreciated, and that this was a new development of the market. But from that moment on, I think it began to be accepted that their open market operations in the gilt edge market were a weapon to achieve the appropriate economic policy that they and the Treasury wished to achieve. And that within that, they accepted immediately that the outside world scrutinized the behavior of the gilt edge market, which was dominated by the banks' supply of stock, or not, as the case may be, and the conditions under which they supplied the stock, whether they held their price or whether they raised their price and therefore accepted a reduction in yields. They accepted that people were looking at that, and that the professional fund managers of the funding institutions, the savings institutions, looked at those results very carefully, the market results, the way the market reacted. And from that moment on, there developed a complete reappraisal of the open market operations.
Who were the main jobbers dealing in gilts at that time, apart from McRoy?
Where Jeff and Francis and Praed were the other two big firms.
Did you have a particular relationship with the government broker, I mean the big jobbing firms, which stemmed from
I
the
think
fact
it would be totally
there?
Wrong to say that we had a particular relationship. Obviously, since we tended to be the vehicles, although they were very fair about this, we tended to be the vehicles through which their open market operations, because we saw the bigger business that came in, one had to keep closely in touch with the dealers of the government broker. But I wouldn't want you to think that we had any indication, any prior indication of any changes of policy. They were very realistic from the very beginning that that would in fact destroy the outside confidence in the market, and that they had to be very level-handed in their treatment of the market.
Yes.
But equally, I think they appreciated on the 7% bank rate, which was particularly after the bank rate tribunal, the famous bank rate tribunal, which came out of that 2% rise. I think they realized full well that the degree of which the responses to the open the response of the market to their open market operations were examined by the outside world.
Yes. Could you describe perhaps your relationship with the brokers dealing in gilts? Were there particular brokers who specialised in gilts?
There were, yes.
And would they then go and get a price from all the all the jobbers dealing in gilts?
Oh yes, I mean they were subjected to the rules of the stock exchange in exactly the same way as everybody else in transacting as a stock exchange an order in gilts. They had to deal to the best advantage under the rules. The best advantage under the rules meant, because they were acting as agents for their clients, meant to the best advantage of their clients.
Yes.
They therefore had to take the to check the prices of the market in general. Now, if they were dealers in a big market, in a big order, they would probably only test the market in the from the big jobbers. It was their expertise that had to decide as to whether this was a an order that could be completed in the small market or the big market.
Was there a pecking order in terms of the jobbing firms in the guilds? I mean,